We'll go ahead and start with our opening prayers. If you'll turn to page 183 in the Gold Prayer Book, I will recite the Shakyamuni Buddha Mantra at the bottom of the page three times. Chaya cha om mune mune maha munaye soha. Chaya cha om mune mune maha munaye soha. Chaya cha om mune mune maha munaye soha. And now if we go to page 34, we'll recite the Four Immeasurables in English. And if you have the white notebook, that's just on the first page of prayers. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And then flip the page, and at the bottom of page 37, we'll chant the Four Immeasurables in Tibetan. Sem chen tam che de wa jang de chick do dong do nagi you dong drill work your chick. And now we'll chant Chenrai Sig's mantra eight times and Green Tower mantra seven times. Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Om Tari Tu Tari Tu Re Soha. 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 Okay, the children can go to their classes now.
He has to answer.
No, you don't have to answer. If you want to answer.
Phew.
Yeah. I know. It's pretty scary up here, isn't it? Okay. So thank you. So anyone else have ideas?
Uh-uh.
Okay, think about it. Who are you with for the next hour and a half?
Huggies.
Hmm?
Huggies.
There's like five different teachers for the different grades.
And one's okay. So anyway, ask them, because you tell them your ideas on what would make a happier world, okay?
Oh.
And then, I have another question. Once you ask it, I want to know why you think that, okay? Yeah. Everyone says you shouldn't ask why to kids. Isn't that true? And if you it's the most ridiculous advice I've ever heard.
I know, right?
Yeah. Don't you agree? Okay. So if you guys want to go, you can go. If you don't forget the question. Yeah. The reason, really, it's very selfish that I use this, because it helps me focus. Otherwise, I go off all these tangents. I think I've been pretty good the last few days, haven't I? Mm-hmm. Have I done many tangents? I don't know. I want to know from people. Short tangents. That's okay. Those are called stories. Yeah. So, thank you very, very much, Donna. Everyone else asked me to come here. I'm not sure I have that much to say. I think I tell stories because I don't know what else to say. I did, just as a short introduction, I won't give my long one, takes long. As a young person of 21, just before I was 21, I moved to Nepal as part of a year abroad program. That was 1975, and more or less stayed till 1988. And that was a long year. I went as a student, was there for a year and a half, came back to the States to finish that last semester at college. And then I had been asked to go back to Kopan, the monastery where I had been studying and working, to help, not help, but to establish a Western studies program for the monks there, the resident monks, the Tibetan Sherpa Nepali monks. Very, very unusual. So I came back to the United States for a year and a half to finish that semester and then figure out a way of how I could go back to Nepal and stay, because in those days, and still pretty much today, you're only allowed to stay 3 months. And I had to figure out, and one of the ways you could stay, there were really only two ways to stay. One was as a student, so with a student visa, or if you were doing development work, then you'd go with an aid agency or something like that. So I found a program here in the States that I could enter as a master's program, as an independent master's degree. And I like to think that I was probably the longest master's degree candidate. So I stretched out 10 more years. So it gave me the great fortune to stay there. It was pretty remarkable to be able to have those conditions fall into place. So where I worked was Kopan Monastery, and I think, of course, many of you probably know about Kopan, but if you don't, Kadampa Center is part of a large family of centers. It's part of an organization of which we have roughly 160, 170 centers today. Back then, there were no centers. It was people who were interested in Tibetan Buddhism and, of course, wanted to study in English, had really only two options for the most part. One was Kopan Monastery, where there was a one-month-long meditation course taught by Lama Yashin Lama Zofa Rinpoche, and they spoke in English. Those days, people would question whether it was English or not, because to understand, particularly Lama Zofa, it was amazing that they could do that. But anyway, the other place was in Dharamsala, India, where the Tibetan government in exile is established. The Tibetan Library Works and Archives also had, they had more classes in English. You know, like it wasn't so much meditation retreat. It was, whereas the Kopan course was a 1 month intensive. Yeah, Lama Zopa would teach 4 to 6 hours a day, and then the rest of the time was spent learning how to meditate on particularly the topic of the Lam Rim. Okay, Lam Rim is sort of the seminal text of this tradition, as you probably know, but Lam Rim is a Tibetan word meaning the graduated path. So it's designed as Lama Tsongkhapa, the founder of the Gelug tradition many thousand years ago, wrote this text as a sort of manual. But it's very long. I mean, it's extensive. Are people familiar with the Lam Rim? Yeah. That means some people are. Are people not familiar with Lam Rim? So that's really the core of our instruction that we receive. Vehicle or our model, like a better word. So we spend a lot of time studying and engaging with that set of teachings, the Lam Rim set of teachings. And there are many variations of it. Lama Tsongkhapa wrote that text, which is quite long, and then they wrote shorter ones, and then there's commentaries and things like that. I have for those of you who are familiar with it, I do have a question about this. Does it seem more Tibetan, or does it seem like it could be modern? Does it seem more traditional or modern when you study it, when you look at the topics? No one's going to say. Traditional, isn't it? I think, maybe it's a rhetorical question. It does seem traditional. So you're reading things that you're looking at that were for an audience, you're thinking, is this 1,000 years ago, or is this a Tibetan audience? So I just want to put it in your ear that I have a belief that it's a psychological manual. Okay? It's just that we have to unravel it and translate it. And that's kind of, I feel, part of my mission, if I could be so bold as to say that. I mean, that's a pretty big statement. But, you know, in whatever way I can do that, because when one of the key principles that I studied with Lama Yeshe, just great, great fortune, I can't tell you, until he passed away in 1984, so 8 or 9 years, and I've had the great fortune to be able to continue my studies with Lama Zopa Rinpoche. But Lama Yeshe was a very unique, very, very unique figure in modern Tibetan Buddhism, in the sense that he was committed to communicating these ideas so that anyone could understand them. He understood. So a couple of things that he imbued us with, I mean, over and over again, besides he himself being universal, it was remarkable that he could still go in and out of the Tibetan community. He was a monk, scholar, and could go in and out of it. And then he would come to San Francisco, and come to the West, the modern world, go to the gay parade in San Francisco, and, you know, in his pants, or generally he always wore his robes, but generally go over there, or go to UC Santa Cruz and be a visiting professor for 2 years, go to Arizona and study at, what's that place in Arizona? Sorry. Where they developed the atomic bomb? Yes. Los Alamos. He went down there to study, you know, physics, because he wanted to kind of try and understand physics. He took, you know, a cruise through the Baltic Sea on his own. It's really funny. After that Baltic Sea cruise, because he really wanted to understand. He didn't do it for himself, like, I want to go take a cruise to relax. He did it because he was so much devoted to how does the rest of the world think, because I want to share these ideas. So his message to us was that these ideas, when you hear things that sound so kind of foreign in Buddhism, he would over and over say, no, no, these are universal principles, these are universal ideas. He used to tell us that you need to be able to teach these ideas so that your mother can understand them. You don't hear that. Or you didn't hear that then. And so you had to think hard about, you know, studying a profound teaching like dependent arising or emptiness, or, Even things like refuge. How do you explain refuge to your mother? Seems very religious, you know? Seems very Buddhist. But from Lama Yeshe's point of view, everything could be explained. Unless it was specifically Tibetan. For example, are water bowls Tibetan or Buddhist? I mean, not that they're not Buddhist if they're Tibetan, but is it a Tibetan creation or is it a Buddhist universal principle creation ritual? Tibetan? How many say Tibetan?
Because the water is clear, the water in Tibet, the nature of the water in Tibet.
Mm-hmm.
But generally,
okay. Did around Buddhist time was there water bowl offerings?
No.
We don't really know. My guess is this is it's a Buddhist tradition, but it represents a universal principle because water bowl offerings were designed. Their main purpose is to help us develop a sense of generosity. Okay, so. It's possible we could do some Western form of generosity creating ritual. We probably have it. Maybe it's those little boxes at the grocery store that you put your change into. Do you have those here? Yeah. Anyway, maybe something a little more formalized. But I don't think, and we do, and I hope Lama Zopa doesn't strike me down. Hope he's not. Don't tell him, okay, I said this. Yeah, thank you. But until we have something to represent as equal of a powerful practice as water bowls, we should do water bowls. How about that? It's a good qualifier. But my feeling is that when I would see Lama Yeshe, for example, he loved beautiful things. And he would come to the West on teaching tours and come back and he'd unpack these. I don't know whether it was clothing or cloth or crystal bowls or candle or china for teapots and that sort of thing. And you could, at first you go, God, he seems sort of materialistic. And I remember when we got married there, I think this is a true story. We got married at the monastery at Lama's insistence. He was very pushy for me to get married. It's like, I don't know why he was so pushy. But anyway. And I think my wife's Australian and her parents brought a Royal Dalton tea set. I didn't know what that was, but I guess it's something good. Right? And I think that I gave it to him. And I think that, if I got this right, it was going. Then, you know, a month or two later, someone was having an interview with Lama Yeshe and they came down and said, look what he gave me. And it was the Royal Dalton tea set. It was always like that. You know, he came back with beautiful things, but they wouldn't stay in his room necessarily very long. But his altar was very interesting. It was sort of modern. You know, he had water bowls of a beautiful crystal glass, and then he had all these little animals, porcelain animals that he picked up from all over the world, and those would be on his altar, representing all the living beings. Just because he was trying to represent, you know, the universality for us. Of the practice. Okay? So, that's our job. I think our job is to figure out. You know, these ideas are not, they're not religious even, as I've been saying in the other classes. Clearly, you know, the 100 volumes the Buddha himself spoke, those are the sutras, 100 volumes, are often categorized in three different collections. Okay? The three baskets sometimes referred to. And His Holiness has said, I've kind of put out that all three of those baskets are psychological trainings, teachings on psychology. And His Holiness recently said, I think I was being a bit liberal, but anyway, His Holiness recently said that the two of the baskets are clearly psychology. Isn't that amazing? So, you know, when we think about a religion, we don't think of psychology. So I'm a little suspicious that we should think of Buddhism as a religion. It's definitely a system of thought. It's not just philosophy, because most philosophies that we look at don't have a practice to go with them. You know, I'm generalizing. It could be. I don't know all philosophies. But when you think about studying philosophy in college or wherever, there's not an actual practice that goes with that philosophy to help us actualize those, integrate those ideas. Whereas in Buddhism, so do we call it a philosophy or do we call it psychology? So as a philosophy, yes, it is a philosophy, but there's probably very little of the philosophy that's meant to be just philosophical ideas devoid of actualizing and integrating your mind with those ideas, okay? So I don't even know if I just finished the story about Lama Yeshe. What was I saying about? Where did it start from? Oh, universal principles. So he said, yeah, teach for your, so your mother will understand. So I implore you guys, it's whether your mother or your culture where you're living, you know, this is, North Carolina is a different culture than California, of course, but we have the same challenges. So, for example, how do you explain these ideas and make them useful in my case? So, for example, one thing is I have been a therapist for a long time and then to start doing coaching in companies. Do you take these ideas and you sit with your client and you try and integrate them for him or her? Or do you rely on, you know, like I was trained as a psychotherapist and I have a master's in clinical psychology, and then I was doing therapy, and I told people the story the other night, you know, so what do you think? So I had spent about 14 years out of the country, you know, about most of that in Nepal, studying these ideas, working with Tibetan refugees, working with these Tibetan monks and kids and studying them. And then I come and at Lama Zobo Rinpoche's recommendation, I got a degree in psychology and, you know, and got my license as a psychotherapist, as a counselor. And then, one day, in Santa Cruz where I live, Lama Zobo was visiting and one of his teachers, our gurus. And I had asked him, I'd moved my office and I asked him, asked Rinpoche if he would come and consecrate the new office. Kind of a traditional thing we do. And he agreed, and he said, well, I'll bring Chud Rinpoche as well, because he was, of course, in town. So I'm driving them to my office. This is a 10-15 minute drive. And Chud Rinpoche is sitting in front, because he's a senior teacher, and Lama Zobo Rinpoche is in the back. And we weren't talking, because Chud Rinpoche... Actually, the reason we were talking probably because Chun Rinpoche didn't talk much in those days. Anyone have contact with him in early days? He talked a little more the last couple of years of his life. I mean, he didn't. He was just very quiet. Very quiet. So anyway, but the thing was that Rinpoche had told me that, you know, it's better we don't speak in English because he doesn't speak English and Chun Rinpoche doesn't speak English, so it'd be impolite, you know, just to chat. But there was a moment, just a few moments, when out of nowhere, from the back seat, Rinpoche said to me, you know, about my therapy work, I guess. He says, you know, if you're just helping people feel better, there's really no benefit. It's like, it's like, you know, the near-death experience when your life passes before you. I saw all of my clients flash before me. Oh, I mean, it seemed like all of them. And I could, not even one, it seemed, did I work with outside of that motivation. In other words, every one of them, I was mainly focused on helping them feel better. Because, you know, they come and people often say, what kind of work do you do? And I said, I work with problems, you know. Because that's what, you know, people don't come see a therapist to tell them how great things are, do they? It's like going to a dentist, you know. Hey, I just want you to know my teeth are doing great. It doesn't happen. So really, and this is honest truth, is that I felt I can't keep doing this work. Either I don't have the courage to do it otherwise, or I probably, it's more of a courage thing. Because I didn't want to be seen as strange and weird. But here I had all these years of this psychology that we're talking today, you know, this traditional psychology that modern psychology can't hold a candle to yet. I spent, you know, a couple years studying, getting my degree, and it was hard because I take these theory classes in modern psychology. And I guess I'm, you know, maybe it was my arrogance, my bias, but it didn't make the same kind of sense as Buddhist psychology did. It wasn't uniform. They didn't even agree amongst each other. And, big problem, is that, anybody here is therapists, psychologists, social workers? Yeah, come on. There might be more, but they're afraid to say, huh? How many of you, okay, so let's just deconstruct the word for a second. Psychologist, let's just say, it might be a psychotherapist, but just, or a social worker, but for the sake of the conversation, psychologist. What does that word mean?
Yeah. Science of soul.
Science of soul, science of the psyche, right? Or science of the psyche, sometimes referred to as mind. Psyche sometimes because of mind, soul. You're right. In the dictionary, both words come up. And ologist, I think, means student of or studier of, right? Or the study of psychology. So I want to ask you, so the rest of you are off the hook right now. But the people who have mental health background, you're a psychologist. You're a studier of the psyche, of the mind. How many of you received a definition of the mind? Did you? Did anyone? There was another woman over here somewhere. No. I always say, it's one of, I told the people the other night, that's one of my soapboxes. I just cannot accept that. And I'm not joking. I think it just really bothers me. Like I often say, if you're a heart surgeon, you know what the heart is. You get a clear definition, a map of the heart. If you're an auto mechanic, you clearly know what the engine is. You can talk or you can define it. You know, depending on the kind of engine, of course. Now you're playing with people's psyche, their soul, their mind, and you don't even have a working definition of it. What are you doing? Not you personally. But what's the therapist doing then, the psychologist? What's he doing? She, he. He's laughing. Love to know what you're laughing about.
It seems so absurd.
That's the word. I think I'm trying to find the word. Absurd's okay. It's not strong enough for how I feel. It's like incredulous, you know, or something like that. I don't know. But that's just me, you know. And it's not saying that they don't help. That's not the point. You know, please understand. It's not like that. But the name, like marriage family counselor, is a much better name for what happens, or relationship counselor. Mostly what you're working with is relationships. That's okay. But psychologists, psychiatrists, psychotherapists, I think you have to be held to a higher standard. And they have no definition of mind, by the way, still. You know, people have theories, but they don't agree. And I often say that if you talk to a scholar monk, maybe not just any monk, but a monk, a scholar, Tibetan, a Buddhist scholar in Sri Lanka and in China and in Tibet and Nepal, in Korea and Japan and Cambodia and Thailand, and you go to any of them, and you say, "What's the mind?" Now, in theory, you know, as an outsider, you would think, "Well, you don't have to. They don't have to know that. They're religious people." But you see, that's why Buddhism is different. All of them could answer, and they would all give relatively the same definition. We've got to get there with Western psychology, I think. That's our hope. But it's new. It's a new science. So in the modern world, West. Okay. Okay. So you see, the slide worked, didn't it? So one way of thinking in this psychology. Is that when we get very basic, what is Buddha's psychology, Buddhist practice, what's it about? Why does it exist? It's probably true with most religions, actually. They exist to take care of problems, the way I think of it. Right? And when you're, like some, it's not until you have a severe problem, right? A hurricane, or someone dies, or you're sick, or you hear about someone's cancer, then, you know, and then you go for your refuge or whatever your refuge is. Now, sometimes people, the refuge is the doctor, right? Or science. So if you think about for yourself, when you have a problem, where does your mind go for help? Let's think of a problem. Someone can help me with a problem. Something not too mundane, but not too bad. Like something that happens so that, you can't get along with someone you work with. Does that happen? So that's a problem. Where do you go for a solution by default? Well, you go home and you talk to your partner or something or your friends and, this guy at work, I can't stand one more day of him, you know, it's like that. And then your friend says, well, you know what you should do is maybe you should file a suit against him. Harassment. Right? Or maybe you should get your boss to come in and mediate some sort of dialogue. Which are all maybe appropriate, by the way. But I'm trying to capture what is your mindset.
The other person.
The mindset is the other person is the problem. Okay? Correct. And if the other person is the problem, the problem is external to us. If a problem is external to us, then it's logical we'll look for the solution outside of us. So in Buddhist thought, it's very demanding. It's very in your face, as you know. Meaning, it just is not going to support you to figure out first that your colleague is the problem. And there I was with Rinpoche in the back seat telling me that pretty much that's how I was functioning when I knew better. See, it doesn't matter as much if you don't know better. But I chickened out. Because I had all this, at least, I can't say I have any insight, but at least I had content. All those years, and for what use? For someone to come into my office and tell me that their 15-year-old son, they just found out, wasn't going to school, leaving the house and going down to the beach and getting high with his friends, and, you know, could I please take care of this. That's really a problem, which is a problem. Right? I mean, that can be a problem for the family. And then I would go, wow, that's really hard. You know, that's what you're taught. Reflective listening. Have you heard about that? Empathy. That must be really tough. I get a lot of clients come to me and said, you know, I've been to a few therapists and all they do is just listen. That's what you're taught. Which is, I mean, listening is a good quality. I mean, we love someone who will listen to us. But the problem is you're paying someone to try and get your problem resolved. And guess what? It takes more than listening, doesn't it? For the most part. You have to do something, usually. It's like those old, the analysts, you know, psychoanalysts, who would, and they still exist, actually. They sit behind the chair, behind the couch, or behind where you're sitting, so you don't see them, and you free associate. It's kind of like my meditation, actually. Okay, so problems. Now we'll just make it simple. So when we talk about problems, so the shift is, let's see if I got that slide here. Let's see. Yeah. Problems are, I think if we reflect before, especially before we meet Buddhist thought, and even after for a while, problems are seen as the exception, aren't they? You know, life is pretty good for us lucky ones. You know, I just heard about my nephew is in jail. You know, that's kind of a problem. I got to go help my sister. Kind of like that. That's kind of how we think of problems. And Buddhism is a little bit unrelenting. It's saying, and I want to make it very clear, you know that the idea of problems or suffering is talked about a lot, and it always seems to be talked about in the beginning, because when Buddha taught his first teaching, the Four Noble Truths, the third noble truth is the truth of freedom, but the first noble truth is the truth of problems or suffering. And you could think, well, why do you tell that first? Why don't you start with the good stuff? Yeah? Like, you almost can't get to the third one because you get so stuck on the first two. The truth of suffering, and it just seems overwhelming. But We don't start there because, or he didn't start there. I think I know why. And I think it's because we are out of touch. We're totally not in touch with the fact that we're in a problem-saturated state of being. And I don't say that as a downer. And I don't mean, you know, and what do you mean? I have a nice house, I have a nice family, I'm going to go to the, you know, fair, I'm retired, whatever, I don't got a job. You know, I don't know what you're talking about. So that's not the definition of problems, that's, or suffering. That's the big shift we need to make. So I think what I found helpful is, in order for us to understand what is meant in the Buddhist psychology about what our predicament is, which is not so great, is that there's a really a great component to it. That's, I think, what is really necessary to understand. By that, I mean, that. Okay? What I mean to say is there's a state of being, there's a quality of mind that we're not in touch with. Okay? That quality of mind is so extraordinary. You know, and we have little hints of it, like when we look at religious literature and it talks about, you know, whatever. The light of Jesus, you know, or God's love, or, you know, the awakened mind or enlightenment. You know, there's no shortage that people over history have talked about it. So, I guess you could say there must be something there. And people articulate it differently. In our system, in this Buddhist system, it's articulated as a quality of mind, an enlightened mind, awakened mind. And you will definitely, if you haven't, you will have insight into it. If you meditate and you know, follow the formulas and directions, you know, maybe not full insight, but you go, oh, you know, it's kind of like around the corner there, or you get inspired, right? Or you spend time with some lamas who have achieved that. And the path, or the practice is, this is what's very different, I think, than normal faith-generated practices or religions, is that in this practice, you work on developing an insight into that quality of mind, which you have, and I have, but it never functions really, okay? And it's like, in a sense, it's our birthright to have it. And when we feel that, then we feel that this life is extremely meaningful. For those of you who study Lam Rim, we talk about the precious human rebirth. I think with the precious human rebirth, I think it's all potential. Until we get to the point where we'll go, wow, I got something in there. You know, I got this, there's this quality of mind that is so extraordinary that it makes this look like so distasteful. Seriously. It's like going on a cruise and having that food. Has anyone been on a cruise before? How's the food?
Quantiful.
And generally qualitiful. Right? Then you come back, I mean, you know, if you got off, I mean, this is a metaphor, but, you know, if you got off, or analogy, if you got off the ship after, you know, 2-3 weeks of eating that food, you're probably not going to run to Denny's. Do you have Denny's here? You must have Denny's here. You know what I mean? It's just not, you can see the potential of what you could have, what you have had. So when more and more we develop that insight, that quality, that familiarity with that quality of mind, then everything else starts to lose its luster. So it's not so hard, like when we talk about renunciation, you really should renounce this, renounce that. And I think, you know, it's good to renounce, but real renunciation is not giving up your house, your good clothes, your car. You know, you might have to, but it's giving up, renunciation becomes sort of natural at a certain point, where, you know, it's like having Pete's coffee versus Denny's coffee. The Denny's coffee, I think they made it better now. I heard that competition. It's not like you can say, oh, I renounce Denny's coffee. You just don't want it. It's just like low quality. You know, if you think about dogs or cats, when they eat their dog food or cat food, how do they think about their dog food and cat food? They don't think it's bad. But, you know, it looks like, we can only extrapolate or assume, but it looks pretty good to them. But to us, we wouldn't even touch it, right? So then Buddha, what he taught was, well, yes, we have that potential, that quality of mind, but you're not there. I want you to be there, but you're not there. You're not there because of this. So that's why we go back in the problem when we talk about problems. There's a lot of psychological movements right now. Not a lot. I mean, there's certain, like, positive psychology, narrative therapy, appreciative inquiry, things like that, which I really support. But I've worked with them, and I use those methods because they're positive and they're more encouraging. But the problem with those that they have is they don't know how to talk about problems. They don't have to talk about pathology. Because they saw what happened in traditional therapies and psychology, which are very psychopathologically oriented, right? You're depressed. You're bipolar. Now bipolar is pretty the popular one, isn't it? Before, some years ago, it was ADHD. Okay. Not saying that something's not happening, by the way, for that person. I'm talking about the pathology, the label. What happens when you give a label like to a kid about ADHD? What's that? They try and live up to it. Even unconsciously, right? Or subconsciously. There's. I'd like to share with you a little more why they might do that. Or bipolar, or depressed. Depression's a great one. It's really profound. Very, very, not the other ones, but depression to me is really curious. What happens in ADHD or depression or bipolar is you have some experience. There's something going on, you know. And then people begin, especially for kids, poor kids in that sense, because adults around them who are the authority start to story it a certain way, right? You know what I mean by storying it? Then we create a narrative or a description, a conversation about it. Unfortunately, the conversation they have has gone in this direction. I say unfortunate because it's not a very encouraging conversation. And if you're a child, you know, you don't have the discriminating faculties. You probably do, but you don't have the power to go, I'm not really that. That's just a description. But that's not what happens. Even for, in our culture now, expand it to adults, same thing happens. Depression. Okay? And if you go see most people for help with depression, what happens? What happens is you become more depression. Why? Because the way, and this goes back to Buddhist psychology, the way the mind works is that it fuses with everything. The identity fuses. What I mean by that is, if, let's take kids, because here's an example. When you start talking about attention deficit disorder, what I mean by it is their identity, becomes fused with attention deficit disorder. And they label it, because we're always labeling ourselves. I'm a mom, I'm a dad, I'm depressed, I'm ADHD. And when you're working with someone, help get them out of their problem, part of the problem is how deeply has their identity fused with the problem. That's why I find depression very interesting, because depression has an extra special power to fuse with people's identity more than a lot of other problems. Maybe not, but just when I seem to, it's almost like takes, it's like the Star Trek.
My nose.
Huh?
My nose.
Yeah, the Borg, right? You know, sorry. I watch too much TV. But the Borg takes Jean-Luc over, right? Until he's almost, what is this, this part of his face doesn't have the Borg taken over? Yeah. That's like depression. When someone comes in, I work with depression, I see like how much of their being has become depression. Now, it's not really depression, but they think it is. why I think that Buddhist psychology is amazing is because it teaches us that we are not the thing. Okay? And this goes to very, very deep levels. All the way from, you know, I'm not my anger. I have anger. Right? Somewhere, you know, I'm dealing with my anger or my attachment, but I'm not anger. Oh, okay, then what are you? Now, in psychology, they don't say, oh, what you are. In Buddhist psychology, we have an answer for that. It's a little bit obtuse. But we'd still have an answer of what you are. And it's not the disease. It's not the problem. Okay? That's why if you start thinking, for those who do engage in this, these ideas, you know, start thinking as a psychology and it's your therapy. You have to become your own psychologist. You have to be your own therapist, seriously. And you study with different people to help you be a better therapist to yourself. But only you and, you know, I can do this for ourselves. That's the bad news. I think that's why Buddhist thought is not for everybody. Because you have to take accountability and, like, that's hard. It seems hard, but in the end it's not hard, right? In the end it's easier than going, I mean, I know people have been seeing therapists for 30 years. Now, it's okay. They have maybe a different goal. I think ultimately everyone wants, is looking actually not just to take care of their relationships with their friends and partners and stuff. I think generally people are looking for a solution, don't you? Something that lasts. Okay? Let me see where I went from. Any questions? So problems are the norm. Yeah. Back there somewhere? Yeah. Wait for the mic because we're streaming, I think. So.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Could we say that more than psychology is a logic system?
Definitely it's a logic system. 100%. The reason I think of it as a psychology... Okay, let's go to that. Why? That's a good question. So, why would we use logic? So the goal... Why I think it's psychology is because we have a goal, right? We have a goal. And the goal is... that's a good point. So... In a simple, very simple formula, because we don't have a whole lot of time, the simple formula is every living being is looking to be happy. Do we need to discuss that, or do people agree? Anyone disagree with that? So as I said the other night, it's even the young girl who's, you know, into cutting. Or I have a young family friend who committed suicide. He was 17. You know, hung himself. People say, no, he wasn't trying to be happy, you see. And of course he was trying to be happy. He just didn't know the method. I mean, I understand why people cut themselves or self, you know, harm themselves. I understand why. You know, the pain is so intense in there, inside of them. I get that. That's not, so there's no judgment about that. It's just not the right approach, unfortunately. They didn't have anyone around them that could help them. Or they had too many blocks to hear the help. So coming from that point of view that every instant of our being, of our existence, might be a bit bold, is a seeking for happiness. Even right now, we're here looking to be happier or happy. No one's here looking like, oh, I like more problems, more pain. So I often point out that, you know, even when we shift our bodies, that's to be happier, right? Our legs are stiff, that's unhappiness. So happy is maybe not the 100% best word, it's a bit simplistic, but let's just say it's, you know, let's just put it in that. Understand it in its context. So logic versus psychology. So in this system, I think if we accept that everyone's looking to be happy and that religions look to fulfill their happiness. Materialism is designed to make you happy. You know, these are all methods. These are all vehicles to be happy, right? Science is the vehicles to be happy. It's going to, you know, science is going to control over the material universe, because it's the material universe that causes most problems. Not enough water, climate change, war, violence, you know. So it's like, well, we'll fix this by some material fix. Okay? So that's philosophy, is that the problem is again out there, and the way to be happy is to make the environment as, you know, functional and controllable as possible. It's not, it'll never work. That's a different story, but and I think everyone here probably knows that. But so then science had the way to be happy. Medicine, the way to be happy is, you know, it's so funny when you read about these studies on, you know, we can live forever, and these people study. Anyway, so that's going to make you happy if you can live forever. You live forever with unhappiness. I mean, so, one second. So every system of thinking is to be happy. So in the Buddhist context, to my friend back in the corner, is that those are all wrong approaches. That happiness is an inside job. And if we talk about inside, we're not talking about the body, because the body can't really be happy, you know, the source of happiness. It can be happier, it can be helpful. But the happiness, we're talking about happiness, is a mental state. If it's a mental state, then it has to be approached mentally. It's never going to be solved physically. So once we get, now most people don't know what we're talking about right now. Default mode, right? Most don't know this, unfortunately. It's the, you know, Sunday football is going to make me happy. Okay? It's out there. And all that's okay, by the way. I mean, we can't judge that it's wrong, because people are at all kinds of different levels. So it's not that we say, oh, they're wrong, we're right. We've got to be very careful of that. Okay? When you meet a beggar in the road, do you teach them the philosophy? Or do you give them some food? Or you give some food, you give some money, whatever. You know, I mean, of course, ultimately the philosophy is psychology. So you see why we call it a psychology is the problems arise mentally, and the solution is mental. So that to me is a euphemism for psychology. Okay? Okay. You use logic. Logic is a very important part of understanding and dealing with our psychological challenges. Let me get the microphone, yeah.
Going back to, you know, about the thing about making people feel better. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can't do anything else
right.
For people.
That's right.
And even if your intention is to do something more for them ultimately, if you don't first do something to
of
make
course.
Them feel better, you're not going to be able to
yeah.
benefit them at all.
Right. So... Yeah. And just to go back to that, because I know I talk in generalities and people leave saying, "Yeah, I guess we don't have to make people feel better anymore." So I'm going to tell that guy his nose is really big. So you're exactly right. You know, it all comes down to intention. So when I was working with those clients, if I had the intent, you know, if I had the larger view, you know, the big view of the journey and what really is going to help them, and then I was working them to feel better for the first session or two, so we develop rapport and trust, so that, you know, if they trust me, then maybe we can go a little deeper and, you know, I can help them understand. But that's good. It's when I'm helping them feel better because that's all I think I can do, that's really all they need, and I don't know what else to do anyway. That's different. So it's like, if someone calls you on the phone, and they're going on and on about somebody at work. And I think here's a little formula, the best formula I've ever learned, is always think about the effects of what you do. So my sister calls me. She always calls me from her car. And she's always stuck in traffic. And she has a really hard time with traffic. You know what I mean? Start swearing. Okay, yeah, and you called me. What do you want to talk about? Oh, I was talking about, you know, moms and then, but this travel. God, let this guy get out of the way. Honk, honk, honk. You know, like, well, agitated. So that's a good example, right? So ideally, I'm going to help her calm down, of course. I think, but what motivation? Am I helping her calm down because she's irritating? Am I helping her calm down because long term she needs to figure this out to be a happier person? That would be a better motivation. Usually it's because we're irritated or we're uncomfortable. You know, we oftentimes we help someone feel, not always, of course, but you know, sometimes we're helping someone feel better is because we're not comfortable with their problem. We get that a lot with our kids. Really, God, the kids pull on our hearts the strongest. Or our, maybe our partners, too. Okay? So, just as a parent, for parenting, you can use this as well. When you're, you know, our kids are always coming to us with their struggles and problems at school and stuff like that. You know, what's the best thing to do for them? Who said the other day, give a man a fish, he eats for a day, that thing? Vincent is his name? Mm-hmm. Craig. Anyway, it is, that's a very germane, relevant saying. Okay? So we're on the same page? Yeah. One last thing about, sorry, one more thing. There is something else, and I forget to say this. There's a deeper level. As the word for Buddhist in Tibetan is not Buddhist. Buddhist is a Sanskrit word. I don't even know why we use it in English. I think because English uses so many words from other languages, it just naturally take on Sanskrit words. But you know, Buddha means awakened one. Great word. Awakened one. So it doesn't mean, you know, God or something, or, you know, omniscient one. It means awakened one, okay? So Buddhism is the path of awakening. If you're Buddhist, you're an awakening person, or you're trying to be. Okay? So, in awakening, now what it means is that awakened mind, it's awakened mind, again, psychology. So the awakened mind is the goal. And as we go, if we trace our steps backward, what creates the awakened mind or what activates the awakened mind, it's two things. I mean, it's many things, but really it just comes down to two things. The awakened mind is generated, nurtured, created from two things. One is understanding reality. The other, which is combined with that or tandem with that, is a heart that's dedicated to others, or a attitude that is direct, dedicated to the welfare of others. And it's hard to say that because it sounds like something emotional or intellectual. It's not. It's not. It's spontaneous. Okay? Do you have to think about taking care of yourself? What I mean is, when I reach for this coffee, do I have to think, oh, myself needs to feel good from coffee, so therefore I got to go there and then I'm going to have some. Okay, I took care of him. We don't. We do it spontaneously, don't we? Instinctively. Unfortunately. Bad long-term habit. Okay? So in this attitude of care, of this compassion, it does the exact same thing. It's not contrived. It's not conceptual. It just naturally takes others as the focus, others' well-being as the focus. The reason is because of the wisdom part. The wisdom part, it understands reality. And the reality is this I that I cherish so much doesn't even exist that way. So why, once you see that, how can you feed it? You see what I mean? You just can't. It's like, if you don't have a glass there, you can't pour water into it. So when there's no view of that wrong self, there is a right self, but that's not it. When there's no view of that wrong self that always wants to be taken care of, always, you know, when you stretch your legs, it's that self. It's the wrong self. The misconceived self. So that's why I really want to stress about the taking care of, you know, the what we said about making people feel good is, of course, with that attitude, you might be making people, you will be making people feel good too. Not always, you know, that might not be the best thing for them, so you won't do it. But you're only thinking of their welfare. Okay? As I often say, when you go see someone like Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa and you have a problem, emotional problem, you don't necessarily always come out feeling that much better, short term. Because that's not what they're working on. They're helping you become long term better. So you might come out with, you might, yeah. It depends on the person, right?
Yeah, I was wondering, because many of us are parents, and even as our kids grow older, they become adults, we're still parents.
Yes.
And they have issues.
Mm-hmm.
We're not trained psychologists.
So, good.
Yeah, you know, so when you're dealing with something like depression, ADD, ADHD, I find that people are very possessive about that.
Yes.
That have it.
Yeah.
And also they're very defensive.
Yes.
It's like you're trying to take something away from them.
Yes.
It's like, no, I got this. Now I know what my problem is.
Right.
And now you're trying to tell me.
Yes.
You know. So how do you deal with that? How do you help people? Because it's a struggle.
It is a struggle.
Yeah.
I agree. My answer to that is I'm going to retire. the answer that I find, that's a great question. I think that that's more of a personal answer for you, is that I think of myself as a Buddhist practitioner, meaning a practitioner trying to develop these awakened qualities. And Lama Yeshe, I told the other night that, you know, I used to help organize the November courses at Kopan. And those courses tended to be pretty strict. You couldn't leave the hill. You couldn't smoke cigarettes. You know, the second 2 weeks, you just ate once a day, keep silence till noon. I heard they loosen them up now, you know, because my kids have been to them. I said, no, we didn't have to do that. Dad, we ate twice a day. And it was hard. I said, well. I said to them, did you have the fleas jumping all over you and, you know, sitting in the dirt? No, we had hot showers. And our hot shower in those days, honest to God, first of all, the water was down the hill, so you'd go, you know, 100 yards down the hill, get a bucket, bring it up, or sometimes the boys, the kids would bring it up for you, put it in your patio or outside in the sun while you went and did your, the morning stuff, come back at noon for your hour and a half break, and then pour the water over, and that was your hot shower. You know, it worked just as well as the hot showers, really. Anyway, so my conclusion. So Lama Yeshe said, when one of the courses, the people were being quite loose and taking liberties, going out, whatever, you know, not keeping the discipline so well. And so myself, being a fundamentalist, went to see Lama Yeshe to, you know, we got to tighten this thing up. And remember, I thought I would have an ally in Lama Yeshe. Of course, that was rarely true anyway, because that wasn't the way he taught me. Or help me. So I went to him and I said, Lama, explain the whole thing to him. He listened very intently. He's listening. And then I'd think, okay, what's the command going to be from on top to all these people? He looked at me and he said, it's okay. The people are at different levels, dear. People are at different levels. So, that's where they're at. That's the level of help they can appreciate, that they're open to. It's when people are not, or have another kind of openness, then you have avenue and permission. So if we don't have permission, you can't do it. You don't have permission, I think. And that's a sort of loose concept. Maybe with your kids you do have permission, but your next door neighbor you don't. Someone comes into my office, in a way they're giving me permission, aren't they? So I need, and I didn't, wasn't taking that permission, unfortunately. I needed to take it a little more by maybe pushing them a little bit differently. But so that's my answer. I think that's the nature. I think that's when we talk about the world is suffering. Because suffering, as you know, suffering in Buddhism is really, if you can't see that ignorance is suffering, then you don't understand the Buddhist word suffering. Okay? So with those people, and we're generalizing, there's a film of ignorance that they can't see a little deeper into the effects in the understanding of them, you know, their own self-identity. So for example, you can't teach that your self-identity doesn't exist. You can't teach that to people unless they're ready. Because, you know, they become psychotic. Remember when you're on, I don't know how many people took acid, but, you know, if you started thinking on acid that you didn't have an identity, you know, pretty scary. Yeah. Okay? Okay. That's my Reader's Digest answer. Yeah.
I'm no longer in the mental health field. I'm in education.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah.
of the fact that a lot of things I saw were a matter of education.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry. But there's something that keeps sticking for me. Because what I did get trained in mental health was not specifically Western. I went to Naropa University.
Oh, yeah.
Which tries to blend
yeah.
them. And one of the things that that sticks with me is that you have to get a self before you transcend
yeah.
yourself.
Yeah.
So, can you say something?
Yeah, I can, because that's a good point. There's so many good points. Mm-hmm. Another one that's often misunderstood, people become familiar with Buddhism and Buddhist thought, it's almost like they become... I think the idea is humility is some sort of weakness. Ramayesha used to say, way back then, it's amazing, 40 years ago, he said, I'll tell you a story. I like stories. So one year we had, often this course, you know, people come looking for different kinds of people come to these courses, as you know, and some of them may even not so mentally stable. So we had one girl there, and she had a psychotic break during the course. And she was, you know, really out of control, and it's like breaking windows and things like that, you know, and in the monastery, and just it was really outrageous. And the course, meditation course leader, which was always a Western monk or nun, not the teacher, which is Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe, but the leader of, you know, lead the meditations and that sort of thing, was one American nun who was very big-hearted, very soft, very gentle. And she didn't know how to deal with, you know. So I remember going up the stairs to Lama Yeshe's room. I don't know why I was going up, but, you know, for some errand or something. And I could hear Lama Yeshe and this nun talking in, you know, through the doors. Hmm. And she was saying, you know, Lama Yeshe said something like, well, she needs help, you know, this girl. And then the nun was saying, but I don't know, you know, it seems like the monastery is a great place for help. And the Lama said, no, you need to take her to the hospital. Now, bear in mind, anyone visit Nepal in the 70s or 80s? Anybody? Scary to think of a hospital, isn't it? Hospitals is really terrifying, you know, the hospitals. I mean, good-hearted, but, you know, they're probably 30 years behind anyway, you know. So... But now it's not like that there. But and then she said she would argue with, she's arguing with Lama, saying, "But we're a Buddhist monastery, you know. We're teaching, you know, we're the embodiment of compassion. Why can't we take care of her?" And Lama's again saying, "No, you need to take her down to Shantabawan Hospital. She needs a psychiatrist." Again, another scary thought. Psychiatrist is scary in some way, not all, but back in those days, you know, it's like one flew over the cuckoo's nest kind of thing. And so, so again, she's imploring and saying, but we're teaching compassion. Lama's opus teaching about bodhicitta. And then finally, Lama just got really forceful. And he said, take her to Shantabawan. She needs a psychiatrist. She said, and he said, Buddhism is for healthy people, dear. Yeah. So of course it stuck with me for 40 years. Buddhism is for health. Now, if we think about, as Buddhists, working with an unhealthy population, that's good. But we're probably not doing a lot of traditional Buddhist interventions. We're helping them get balanced, balanced and stable, you know, so that they can then engage But yeah, I've held that since then, and I think that was what you were asking. Yeah, Buddhism. So and then he used to, I know, he said you need a strong ego to practice Buddhism, not a big ego. He didn't say big ego, strong. I mean, you have to have some solid mental health. And we all have mental disease, by the way. So it's not saying you've got to be free of mental disease. You just have to have a stability. Yeah.
Andre, I have a really good friend who has anger issues, and when I'm with her, the only thing that I realize that I can do, because if I say anything about her anger, the defensiveness just goes like this. So one of the things that I've realized that I can do, one of the only things I can do, is to tell her when she goes off how I feel.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm helping her at least to get some idea of how it affects, which is what Karuna was talking about, how it affects somebody else. And I just told her, you know, my anxiety level would just go through the roof because of my history, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I said, I have to leave the room.
Does it help her? It does help, right?
It did help. Yeah. It made her stop.
Because people care,
for
right?
a second. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, she was, because I wasn't talking about her problem.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking about me exclusively and how it affected me. And, you know, that's pretty much the only thing that I can do that is somewhat, you know, makes her at least stop a bit without the defensiveness.
Let's say one more not one more thing, but something, maybe a little tip that I learned in all these years trying to work with people is, and at some point it'd be nice to talk about it more extensively, but if you can just kind of remember this, is what you were saying about asking about effects. What people don't like is asking about causes. And maybe we like it, but generally people feel defensive. Like, why do you get so angry? You know, what was your situation with your parents? I mean, you know, what is it? And causes are very, very important. We know them. But in the common narrative, those conversations don't work so well. What work well is, exactly, so you can is generate conversations around effects. So you could say things like, with the anger, you know, what effect does that have on your kids? What effect does it have on your relationships? What effect does it have on your mood? What effect does it have on our communication, do you think? Okay, and you got to do it in a way that's not blaming. It's like with curiosity. Because people do care. You know, they really do. People get angry like that. I mean, we all care. Like, oh, God, I blew it again. You know, most people, not all. Some people, it is their style. You know, they learn, you know. But for the most part, people do care about effects. And because the person wants to be happy. So you have to do it skillfully. You got to do it, you know, gingerly. But that, as a therapist, in a dialogue with people, talking about effects is the most effective thing I found to do. We got only 5, 6, 7 minutes. Let me just... Any other questions? I'll say a few more words and there'll be more questions. I don't know. Blame. One of my favorite topics. Blame. So we become more sensitive to problems. We have to think, we should have sort of a reflection with ourselves. And so what do we blame? And what was blame like in your family? I'm just kidding, that's a psychology question, but I'm actually, it's always very curious. What did you grow up with? What was the culture of mistake making in your family? What were the cultural values around making mistakes?
Blame the man.
Blame the man?
Yeah,
okay. Anybody else? Okay, my family, did you know that in my family there were no mistakes? We were a perfect family. If you made a mistake, it was someone else's fault. Okay? And the few times it was obviously my fault, you know, it was really, really it was very bad, right? How could you? Kind of thing. Anyone else have, what was the, anyone grow up, my wife's family is really amazing. My wife's family is from Australia. Her family on mistake making was like, oh, you did? Oh, okay. You know? Anyone else got something? You know, it was like, they weren't labeled mistakes almost. I'm not sure they were, but not like in my family where, you know, it's like life. You know? And I have a quick story. It's in the book that I wrote, The Misleading Mind book. One of my teachers, a great lama named Dzong Rinpoche, his incarnation, okay, came to stay with my family with his attendant when he was about 12 years old. And he wanted, in his previous life, previous Dzong Rinpoche had told his attendant that when in his next life he would like to attend an ordinary school in the West. So here he was, showed up. And his attendant was taking care of that request. And he spent about a year with us going to monastery, you know, and with my oldest son and my daughter. And so Tibetans, I don't know if you have much experience with them, but as a culture, they're very generous. You know, they're very serving. Just kind of naturally, I don't know. And so we were... I was working in Palo Alto then, and I'd come home, you know, like 7 or 8 at night, and eating dinner. I'd be really tired, and then my job, because I'm not a very good cook, or I don't cook much, is I would do the dishes. Right? That's kind of the bargain. So pretty soon, after not too very long, you know, I'd be sitting at the table, finish dinner, and the attendant, his name was Tenzing. Tenzing would be in the kitchen before me, washing the dishes. Now, you gotta understand, you know, in India, from where they're from, dishes and sinks and stuff weren't big in those days. You know, it's like under the tap, using some sand, you know, kind of thing, and metal plates or whatever. You know what I mean? So he was doing it, and I thought, okay, well, you know, I started off helping him for a few days, and pretty soon, you know, he was like, oh, maybe I'll watch the news. You know, and I'd be watching the news or watching something, and I noticed he did it really loudly. Clanging the dishes around and that sort of thing. And we ever get rid of this. Sorry, the battery's dying. We don't need this. And so so I was hearing this dishes, and then I think, God, I'm kind of in... And I started looking. I don't know if it's true, but it seemed the plates were getting more chipped. And I had this moral dilemma. Because there I'm sitting, and then I can't hear the clanging, and then I think TV, and then I think the chips on that, and so this went on for some days. I didn't know what to do, and then finally I remember clearly, because I'm a very bad person, and I said, so I'm standing next to Tenzing, you know those things you remember like it was yesterday, and standing next to him, I said, and it's very trying to be as polite as I could, but you know how when you're being polite but you're actually agitated. It doesn't really work. And so I said to him, Tenzing, maybe you could do maybe do the dish a little quieter. And I think there's some chips. I think I haven't even said that. I'm such an idiot. But anyway, so what happened? He looked at me like that, and he said, okay. And went back to washing. Got quieter over the next days, things like that. Not that. You see, he grew up in a place where mistake-making wasn't a blame thing. If you can learn from it, you learn from it. Wouldn't it be nice to be like that? That, I think, is a great way to parent kids. But also to treat your friends, you know, people we work with, all those people, the woman who gets angry, you know, your friend or rather, I know it's a woman. The blame. Where do we place blame? I'm about to stop. 1 minute. I think it's one of the most profound practices that we can do is to begin to analyze blame and what we do with that. And it gets very, 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 very profound. Yesterday, I got a ride here with someone who had warned me they're not a good driver. And we were going 35 in the 45 lane. And I could see in the rear view mirror this line of cars behind us. And I, you know, honestly, I have to say, I have to compliment myself. I really didn't get that agitated. Normally I would. You get agitated. Okay, so when the agitation comes up, we automatically blame. And you say something like, you know, did you know you're in a 45 zone? And like that. So that's one level of blame, right? But where else, where's the real level? Where's the real object of blame? And we say inside of us, where? What? So as we practice, we begin to understand. So we learn from education that the real object of blame is number two. We could say it's an interdependent thing. And it's interdependent on, you can either blame the sense of I that you're holding strongly that doesn't exist that way. You can also hold you can also focus on the actual affliction, which is, say, in this case, anger. You can focus on either one of them. And then, as good, you know, as we practice, then you get deeper, you actually see, the I that's agitated because she's going 35 into 45, and maybe be better if I just drove, even though, you know. So you've got that I coming up. That's the problem. Okay? So the problems are not like, you know, your nephew's in jail, or, you know, you can't get along with your coworker, or climate change. Those are not the problems. Those are the conditions. They're not problems that we're talking about. We're talking about internal problems. So the internal problem is that wrong sense of self, that sense of I. So that then becomes the opportunity for practice, right? Because you know that clarity of mind we were talking about? That clarity of mind is the absence of that wrong conception of I. The moment that I dissolves, the clarity of the mind awakens. So simple. You don't have to work on awakening that clarity. Like, there it is. I know I saw it the other day. You know, you can do that. I don't think that's as effective as in focusing on this wrong concept of a concrete self-identity. The identity that you're sitting there right now. Okay? We did this the other evening. And if I called out your name, if I knew everyone's name, which I don't. If I called out your name, Andre, right? So if I say Andre, everyone here has a different experience of that than you do. Your experience is something like, oh, he's talking to me. Right? So his sense of self comes up stronger. So anyone we call like that, that's how you get your sense of what I'm talking about. Because if it sometimes it seems a bit vague or obtuse, like what is this emptiness of the eye, like that. So that Andre, when he gets that come up, that eye, when you say he's talking to me, that sense, that self-identity does not exist that way. Okay? And when you see it doesn't exist that way, that's the emptiness of it. And that, what is there in place of that, is that clarity. Because that I is very, very crowded. It takes up all the space in our mind. And then it interacts with these afflictions. Let's say, I say, Andre goes, and then maybe his sense is nervousness. So the affliction is the nervousness, the mental factor, the mental stuff, the cloud in the sky is nervousness. So you can focus on that. That doesn't really exist that way. It seems so real, but it doesn't. But I think more effective is to go to the subject of nervousness. That's our job, okay? That psychological health comes from that. I'm not just being cute. That is the solution. Because when you say, I have ADD, that's the ADD guy. Very strong identity. Very strong sense that that is real. Okay? Or I'm an alcoholic. I'm a recovering alcoholic. Right? All that, I. It does different levels of strength due to the fact that we believe it. So a lot of psychology, ultimately, psychotherapists or therapy, ultimately is strengthening that I. And that's why it's not so healthy in a way. And on the other hand, sometimes you need to strengthen the, like the eye of compassion, the compassionate person, that's a better eye. You know what I mean? There are value judgments around this eye, but ultimately there's no eye that's compassionate either. But if you're going to start becoming healthy, you exchange the healthy wrong concepts with the unhealthy wrong concept, okay? I think I have to stop. 12 o'clock. Does that make sense? I hope it makes sense. I really want you to leave with, you know, a sense of what?
Yeah.
Now our prayer leader.
Okay, we'll go to page 246 in the Gold Prayer Book. This is also in the white notebook, and we'll say the verses from Shantideva. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. And just a couple of quick announcements. Whether you were able to attend the Light of the Path retreat or not, we have kind of a special treat coming up on the next few Wednesday evenings. Venerable Chuki and Venerable Lama, who both attended the entire retreat, will be leading some discussion groups based on sections of teachings that Lama Zopa Rinpoche gave. So if you're interested in coming, we'll be putting up on the calendar. If you click on Wednesday for the calendar, then you'll get a little bit of text that you can look at ahead of time and kind of be ready to talk about it. And we'll also have a link to that section of the teachings when Rinpoche was teaching on that. And then I think Kim's got a quick announcement also.
Yeah, so we've been talking a lot about mental things and mental happiness, and so, but now I'm going to talk to you about a thing. This thing is actually a mala. There are prayer beads, and the wonderful thing about being a Buddhist is that when it breaks and they go, beads go all over the floor, you can say, well, you know, I knew it was impermanent anyway. So if you have some things that are impermanent in your closet, waiting to become kind of a thing again, that is useful to help concentrate our mind on many mantras and prayers, we are having a session for making one of these if you have not made one before, and repairing if you have some in your closet that need to be repaired. And that's going to be next Saturday at 10 o'clock. And bring the beads, and we have all of the things and instruments that you need to make it into an actual useful prayer utensil. Oh, and also, if you want to become a member, today I'm having a new member meeting all the way in the back of the Gampa, and well, good to see you. Hope to see you there.
Thank you.
Yes, and if you've enjoyed Karuna's this morning, he's going to be also teaching this afternoon, wrapping up the workshop we had this weekend on the misleading mind, but no need to have come earlier, so please come back at 1:30 and we'll resume teachings until 4:00.